It's a great honour for me. I'm John Howell, I'm trustee of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, to welcome you all on behalf of the Foundation to the 2017 Max Watson Annual Lecture. This evening, Professor Chris Hodges will present his research into the concept of ethical business regulation, or EBR, which aims to foster a business culture of mutual engagement, respect, learning, and constant improvement based on social trust. Now, in the audience this evening are undergraduate and graduate students, researchers, and established academics, regulators, commissioners, policy advisors, and lawyers, to name but a few, all from a wide range of entities. And the combination of talent on and off the podium with the topic of Chris's lecture promises a lively event. It also underlines how the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society is living up to its byline of bridging the gap between policymakers and academia and bringing high-quality academic insights to a wider audience. In May alone, we had events on free speech, terrorism, and the will of the people. And the annual lecture tonight rounds off the programme for the Trinity term. Bridging the gap between academia and policymakers was also the stock in trade of the former FLJS trustee in whose honour this lecture is given. Max Watson, whom I knew as a colleague and a close friend, and whose tie I'm wearing this evening, did so by thinking outside the box, by recognizing alternative and telling perspectives, and finding ways to speak truths to power. As Max's successor at FLJS, I recognize in Chris similar attributes of uniqueness. Like Max, Chris thinks about real-life problems. He invents a theory after solving the practical issues, rather than vice versa. Now, Max's work was central to solving the Latin American debt crisis and stabilizing the euro, so Chris, the bar's set quite high for you this evening, but I'm sure you'll aim to clear it by a good margin. The very title of Chris's chair is similarly special to him, Professor of Justice Systems. And Chris has had a singular career, Erasmus Professor of the Fundamentals of Private Law at Rotterdam, Honorary Professor in Beijing, as well as Visiting Professor at Canberra, Wuhan and Leuven. Before academia, he spent a very practical 25 years as an international lawyer in the city, chairing the International Bar Association's Committee on Unfair Competition, Advertising and Product Liability, as well as the European Medical Technology Trade Association's Legal Committee. He also chaired various committees for the Department of Health and the Pharmacists' NHS representative body. Chris holds his PhD from King's London on European regulation of product safety and is now a full-time academic here in Oxford. He is an authority on dispute resolution systems as well as regulatory systems. To hear him other than here, you would have had to have been a member of your country's delegation to OECD or UNCTAD, or read his 2015 magnum opus on enforcement and how we think about the design of regulatory and compliance systems. Instead, you can now hear at first hand the basic ideas behind the EBR work of Professor Chris Hodges.
Thank you very much, John. The bar is indeed pretty high, and I'm certainly not going to save the euro this evening. Thank you for coming. It's a great pleasure to be asked to deliver the Max Watson lecture. Rather a surprise, I have to say, but a great honour. I never knew Max, but his reputation for transformative thinking is really rather legendary, and a lecture that he gave here a few years ago is an absolute classic of its kind in relation to regulation. So taking his inspiration, I am trying to identify in this lecture how the evolution of various different strands of policy and practice in regulation, plus compliance and enforcement, have converged and create a transformational opportunity. In short, I aim to show where we've got to in enforcement and regulation and how that opens up both the need and the means of doing things differently and doing them better. So there's a lot, strong strand of better regulation for those of you who are familiar with regulatory policy. The resultant theory and practice has begun to be known as ethical business practice and regulation, or just ethical business regulation. But you'll see how the two bits of practice and regulation fit together. It is basing human activities on ethical values supported within social groups and by regulatory relationships. This need arises because we seem to be unable to stem the tide of major scandals in corporate behaviour, Enron, WorldCom, BCCI, payment protection insurance, selling mortgages to those who'd be unable to repay, selling bundled subprime derivatives, 2008 financial crisis, LIBOR fixing, Tesco systematically paying farmers late, VW's emissions, a cheat device, Rolls-Royce's recent systematic bribery and corruption payments came to light, recidivism in cartels, you read the European Commission documents, the Obrecht bribery scandal in Brazil, short list there. Also in public life, MPs' expenses, phone hacking by journalists, and in sport, FIFA, doping in professional cycling, Russia's expulsion from the Olympics due to institutionalised doping, and so on. There are an awful lot of rather interesting books that one can read, usually written by journalists or people who've been involved in these things, about what happened and why. Traditional approaches to regulation and enforcement are, I suggest, simply not preventing these problems or identifying them early enough. We must undertake a fundamental review of how we do regulation and enforcement. A quiet aside at this point, I get really worried when I look at what's happening in America at the moment, where they are deconstructing regulation and removing barriers to private enforcement, etc. So in a few years' time, they are bound to have a number of major corporate scandals. If you remove both public and private enforcement, it's pretty obvious that that will be the result. Now, the question, however, is what's the new balance between public and private enforcement and how do we look at things? This inquiry that I've been engaged on in the past few years ranges very widely over law and legal philosophy. I don't claim to know much about any of these things, but at least I'm trying to look at them all. Economic theory, enforcement practice, socio-legal research into responsive regulation, human genetics, cognitive and behavioural psychology, ethics, and so on. So all of these things one will pick up. Some of you may have seen outside or be familiar with this book. It's rather a monster at 800 pages, and a lot of the substantiation is in there, although one continues to find other things. So the lessons out of this are what I'm drawing on here. But I hope to simplify the argument this afternoon, or at least some of it. First topic, the evolution of policy on and theory on regulation. Well, what is regulation? The basic purpose of regulation is for society to control how legitimate businesses, legitimate activities are performed. They are legitimate so they can carry on, but it's the question of how do you do it, and saying do it this way rather than that way, please, for the rest of society, so as to conform to the social and economic policies of society represented through usually its authorities. The constitutional basis for businesses, for example, to be controlled in this way stems from their legal and social licenses to operate within a state. Hence, the state imposes controls on economic and social aspects of how businesses operate. I start with some very simple propositions, which I think are really rather important to understand about what is happening. So the familiar regulatory models, one starts off with the top-down command and control model. And then there's the opposite, which is a bottom-up or self-regulatory model. And where we end up is somewhere in the middle. And the question is, where is that and what does it look like? Because there are an awful lot of opportunities. So the top-down one is do what I say. You find that in the military. The bottom-up is perhaps my word is my bond because it's social. Neither model is ideally effective, and there's plenty of literature on that. The intermediary model is seeks to combine elements of the two, and various models of co-regulation exist, such as involving trade sector codes of best practice, of which there are a very large number, or third-party certification, for example, by auditors or notified bodies, if you're familiar with CE marking systems. A development of the co-regulatory model was firmly endorsed by the UK government in this paper issued in January by the Cabinet Office, which was in fact the result of a committee of about 20 regulators, and it's interesting to see who's in and who's out of that group, looking at the direction of travel of regulatory theory and policy in the UK. There's one important strand in this paper, which is frankly to save money. And that's a rather an important issue, but I haven't got time to deal with it today, although it is a key point to bear in mind. However, the major point that I do want to focus on is the fact that this paper said very clearly that the direction of travel in, if you like, co-regulation, is a redefinition of that term, regulated self-assurance. So what they're saying is the owner of the risk should self-assure. In other words, in the business context, the business should know what it's doing and control its own risk, which is rather different from a command and control model where the regulator supposedly controls what the business is doing. So there's a strong element of bottom-up in this, with businesses actually saying we need to know what we're doing. The regulator's role is to ensure that the regulatees are in control of the risk, primarily by assisting. But if the regulatee is not in control, then the regulator's role switches to supervisory policing. Very strong political statement there, and the implications have yet to be worked out. I'm spending quite a lot of time on that with the Cabinet Office now in developing the ideas in an extraordinary range of sectors. One then moves on to, having looked at regulation and what's happening in that area, the question of what's happening in enforcement. This is the back end of regulation, and very few people ever bother to look at enforcement. It's not the sexy bit, but if you ask questions about enforcement, you suddenly find some rather strange conclusions which tell you a great deal about the front end and what it ought to look like. So the associated models, if we say command and control, you look across and say, well, deterrence is the theory that applies there. Self-regulation, you might summarise it as saying honour and reputation. And my main proposition here is to tease out what do we do in the middle? What is the theory? Because there are quite a few regulators, and this applies both between public and private enforcement, who cling on to the historical idea of deterrence. And what I'm saying is, that's outdated, it doesn't fit the model. What do we do in the middle? If we fail to understand why people observe or break rules, then we actually are not helping ourselves, because you don't know how to write a rule, and you don't know how to support the rule, and what to do when people break it, deliberately or by accident. And there's a huge amount of evidence that a great deal of companies, say SMEs, don't know what they're doing, but they would do the right thing if someone tells them, saying just do it this way. The point also applies not just within the external state regulatory system, but within companies, because companies of any size have internal regulatory systems, usually called compliance systems. So shouldn't they actually be doing the same thing as the external system? And if one manages to integrate the two, we might be more efficient about getting people to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing. So there's a strong element of thinking about synchronization here. And if these elements are not aligned or synchronized, it will have obvious consequences in relation to the need for enforcement or the need to find out where things are going wrong. Deterrence has at least two meanings. One is the sort of legal philosophical approach, which comes out of the idea of, going back to Aristotle, etc., etc., about personal responsibility and personal responsibility and taking account of what you are doing. So in other words, when the surgeon was sentenced today in Nottingham, that was him doing things wrong. It's much more difficult to apply in relation to a large group of people. Do you anthropomorphize the company, or do you identify the individuals within an organization who are doing things? Who are you trying to deter? And at that point, the simple proposition might be, do what I say, otherwise I'll hit you. Now, quite a lot of evidence behind that as to, does it work? And the answer is, broadly speaking, no. And there isn't time to go into that today, but there's quite a lot, that a couple of hundred pages in my book, saying this is what we empirically know about deterrence and deterrent penalties in relation to the enforcement of regulation or private enforcement within companies. And the answer is, if you look at the studies properly, and most of them actually assume that there is a deterrent effect, so they're quite difficult to read, but you don't find much evidence. I won't say you don't find any, but you don't find much evidence that it actually works in affecting behaviour. So if one asks a different question, because many regulators would have asked the question, how do we increase deterrence? If you ask a different question, which is how do we affect behaviour, you get a completely different answer. Now, there's an important constitutional point here, which is it appropriate in a modern democracy that we should rule by fear, which is what he's doing? And the answer to that's pretty obvious. So we do need to ask ourselves, for those regulators who are still using deterrence, is what you're doing appropriate, in acceptable in a modern democracy? There's a second meaning of deterrence, which is economic, purely economic, and one goes into rational actors, theoretical calculations, the idea that individuals make decisions, and therefore companies also, because they're making profits, supposedly, make decisions which are an objective calculation about the risks and benefits and the costs of the risks and benefits, and you can affect that ex post by affecting the, or sometimes ex ante, by affecting the calculation. Quite a lot of that, and that's another couple of hundred pages in the book, has been removed or demolished by behavioural psychology, otherwise known as now behavioural economics or behavioural insights. There's a very large collection of studies published by OECD a couple of weeks ago on that. So the whole question about why do people make decisions is up for grabs, and if one looks at the behavioural psychology on its own terms, you come out with some other answers. You still see deterrence being deeply ingrained in legal theory and in public pronouncements. It stems from a said philosophical focus on the individual as morally responsible for one's own actions. But you also find deterrence within corporations' internal compliance systems, and indeed it underlies, for example, the leniency policies that you'd find within the enforcement policy of competition authorities worldwide, or indeed bribery and corruption authorities and various others. There are three ideas behind that. The first is that the corporation is able to control the activities of all its employees. The second is that an internal compliance system is the mechanism that will do this, which traditionally involves having a code of ethics, lecturing staff on ethical responsibilities, and operating extensive compliance systems. And hence, the third point is that companies should be incentivized to adopt compliance systems. But these propositions have not stood up to empirical scrutiny. Moreover, the result of those leniency policies is that corporations seek simply to buy lower fines by putting in place compliance systems, rather than addressing the underlying behaviour and saying, are we doing the right thing on an ongoing basis? Training, procedures and records do not drive or guarantee, certainly, human behaviour or corporate actions. Neither do fines or damages. The threat of sending senior people to jail, such as in the financial services senior managers regime, or, we were talking about it earlier, the NHS duty of candour on all surgeons and nurses, etc., saying unless you are candid with all the patients, you will be committing a criminal offence, sends all the wrong signals to people about what their behaviour should be and ends up with a gaming situation about the behaviour that you produce, which is not what you want. It won't affect most executives or staff because quite a lot of them believe that they're doing the right thing, or that they have no choice in what they do internally, or that they will never be caught. A lot of behavioural psychology behind that. Many legislators, enforcers and judges seek to respond to wrongdoing by increasing deterrence, therefore. The truth, however, is that there is little empirical evidence that deterrence is effective in affecting future behaviour. Certainly in the regulatory context. It is a widely held myth. Not completely held, however. Now, if deterrence fits command and control, what about self-regulation? You think of the city, my word is my bond. People, many sectors that have their own codes of practice say, we all know each other, we've got our codes, we do the right thing, we trust each other. What's the problem? This is spontaneous, voluntary benevolence. People are inherently good. There's plenty of altruism around. Selfishness or the pursuit of commercial goals may overcome acting in the best interests of others. However, my word is my bond is not just a personal commitment, but it is supported by mechanisms of social communities and reputation, as one sees from this picture of these city gents. They're in a particular community, and reputation is very important to them. So, and on the basis of that reputation, they build trust. I spent a long time looking at the enforcement policies of many UK regulatory authorities. And I think we are the only country that has published these. They were almost by accident published after the Regulators Code, which came in 2008, I think originally, required that to happen. You find some very interesting things. On the right-hand side, you find some agencies who officially say that their enforcement policy is based on deterrence. You'd expect to see the Competition Authority, Serious Fraud Office, and indeed the Financial Conduct Agency, which has a policy of credible deterrence. And they get rather annoyed when I say to them, it's not credible, it'll never work. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that? Two surprises. Well, sequence of surprises. One is there aren't too many on the right-hand side. I've thrown in the US down the bottom. On the left-hand side, one finds a vast number, growing number of other authorities that do not use deterrence, but they use the much more self-regulatory approach of supporting behaviour, telling people, look, this is what you ought to do. In other words, supporting performance and improvement. And that's the official approach. It's the official enforcement policy, if one looks through things. Other surprise, there's a small group in the middle who are all economic regulators, created 20 or 30 years ago when particular sectors were privatised. So they started on the right, and they're all moving towards the left. Different speeds, and sometimes they go left a bit and then go back a bit. You can quite clearly see when one traces the documents over time that they're moving away from deterrence and being much more supportive. There are all sorts of reasons for that, but those are the empirical findings about what's happening. There are many public statements that support moving to the left. For example, and I've quoted here a few things from particular statements. The top one is from the OFT, it was 2010. Most people want to do the right thing most of the time. Now that was the consumer side of the OFT, not the competition side of the OFT. They might not know what to do or how to do it, but they could be helped, with quite a few statements to that effect in official documents. Last one's really very surprising for me, because I don't know a huge amount about criminal law, although Julian taught me a few things on the way past. And almost the last document signed off by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary is this modern crime prevention strategy, in which it was accepted that a small number of people do bad things, but then they're not necessarily, as it were, criminal in the traditional approach. And it's not a deterrent approach. It says an important finding from criminology is that the vast majority of crimes are committed by a small minority of people. The evidence tells us that there's nothing inevitable about criminality. No one is doomed to be a criminal by their upbringing. But there are some circumstances, like how levels of self-control, low levels of self-control, which are associated with a higher likelihood of offending. And we know that those characteristics can be influenced by what children experience growing up. So if we're to reduce the likelihood of future criminal behaviour, we need to build positive characteristics and resilience, especially in young people at risk of doing harm or offending. Now, the context there, of course, is perhaps youths who go and do stupid things when they're 17, 18. But the same sort of approach you can see on the previous slide on the left-hand side to people in companies, whether they're SMEs or larger ones. It's a different approach to saying, why are people do things? It's not inevitable. Let's try and look at the root causes and sort things out. A lot of that is very familiar to regulatory scholars within the stream of what's known as responsive regulation. For example, all the work of John Braithwaite and others. And it leads to the conclusion that enforcers should have a well-stocked toolbox of enforcement powers and investigative powers, but should select, in appropriate circumstances, which powers you use. So the classic phrase there, have a big stick, but talk softly, in most cases. The aim should be to agree responses to problems rather than engage in fighting about them. Incidentally, the EU dimension. Really fascinating. The EU does not have an enforcement policy, which is extraordinary when one considers just how much regulatory legislation exists across the EU. They have never looked at what the member states do when they implement directives. There is no policy on that. Reason, the principle of subsidiarity, because it trespasses on the member state competence. And therefore, as far as I know, there have never been any studies, or academics have never really looked at what do the different member states do. And if I go to Germany or France or Portugal or wherever it is and say, what's your enforcement policy? They don't understand what the question is, usually. So they would come out with ideas of deterrence, but is that what they actually do in practice? All sorts of complex questions then arise about levels of self-regulation and different use of codes and chambers of commerce, etc., but we'll leave that on one side. The furthest that EU legislation goes is saying, okay, member states, these are all the provisions. You must have a proper enforcement system. If it's public enforcement, you must have sanctions, and the sanctions must be effective, proportionate, and dissuasive. And that's where they stop. So there's no understanding about what the regulatory architecture should be, what the approach, what the policy, etc. is. So the EU is regulatorily completely incoherent and dysfunctional in that respect. Contrast the UK, where the concept of regulatory delivery is exactly that space. I'll come back to that point later. Now, some examples. Let's just look at how different regulators have done things. Firstly, the Financial Conduct Agency. One could go on at great length about these. I'm just going to whiz through them fairly quickly. In the past few years, I might have got the arithmetic wrong, but the FCA, since 2008 to 2015-16, has imposed, quote, deterrent fines of $3.38 billion on banks. And I saw a document the other day which estimated that the total amount of damages and fines is $25 billion. A lot of money. What's changed? Are banks doing things differently? Does the FCA know what the sources of the problem were, what the root causes were, and has therefore addressed what should happen? What is the empirical evidence? Well, it's fascinating when you read a large number of documents from the FCA and in Europe and G20 and Basel, etc., about all this, together with documents from the City of London Corporation, because the mayor set up a city values programme, and the Financial Reporting Council have done a lot of work on this. And they're all moving towards the idea of saying culture is very important within banks. But they stop short of saying what sort of culture it ought to be. And I think the missing word is ethical culture. You've got to have a value system against which the culture is measured. So the FRC documents are absolutely tremendous, for example, in saying culture is really important. They give you quite a lot of detail, but it doesn't say what sort of. It says, well, we don't like a strong culture or a toxic culture or whatever, but the central point missing. Interesting, the Banking Services Board's first public survey of 28,000 staff in 22 banks published not so long ago found, quote, many examples of good practice, but also identified areas where change is needed and where deep-rooted attitudes and behaviour detrimental to the interests of customers and clients, unquote, as well as workers. It highlighted that responsiveness, accountability, personal resilience and openness are all areas where progress needs to be made. You can see through the sort of official speak saying it's a bit of a mess and we don't quite know how we're going to take it forward. Now, contrast that. Ofgem. What do they do when they enforce? If you look at Ofgem's penalty notices, quite a lot of them are agreed. They contain three elements. The first element is that it's often quite a lot of saying this is what the company's going to do within its training, within its internal systems, looking at are people in the right place. So it's behavioural and systemic. Huge amount of detail. And mostly that's agreed with the companies. The second bit is that you can see from this that the light grey fines have gone down and are continuing to do so. And the typical position I was told by Ofgem is that they might agree you're going to do this and then have a fine of £1. That's a bit different from £3 billion on the banks, going in a different direction. But at the same time, the third element is that paying redress has gone up from nothing to quite a big number. So three elements. Look at the behaviour. Set things right with an address. And thirdly, by all means, trigger the supervisory criminal approach to make sure that the behavioural changes are going to happen and the redress gets paid, so there's oversight. But those are the elements, in which case there's a different relationship. Health and safety executive. About 30 years ago, they came to the conclusion that the level of accidents on construction sites were far too high, were killing people and injuring a lot of people. And they said, what do we do? Do we go around with the big stick and shoot people or not? a report here issued a couple of years ago said, completely different approach, might be familiar. To leverage influence within the industry, supply chain in high-risk areas, engaging with forming partnerships with parties able to affect widespread change, such as company directors, strategic bodies focused on particular interest groups or sectors. HSE's role was as a catalyst, utilising its unique overview from official data important point, of harm being caused industry-wide and expertise in understanding reasonably practical controls, but explicitly relying on those who created the risk ultimately to control it. The new approach centred on influencing or triggering changes, reliant on the action of others. For the theory to work in practice, it was crucial that the risk to be addressed could be recognised by industry as being significant, it's the what, and that parties engaged with the who were relevant and influential. So HSE did various things like an influence network and other bits of detail that I'll leave out for the moment. But that whole approach was a significant success. So if one looks at the statistics for safety on construction sites, basically the UK came down and has stayed down. Now this is data from Florentin Blanc, who has worked with World Bank and wrote a behavioural insights paper for OECD a few years ago. And he's just got a doctorate from Leiden, within which he's compared statistics of various countries, especially Germany, UK and France. So the UK is a success story. He hasn't got a graph, otherwise I'd put that up. But anyway. The opposite approach in France. France has a very large number of inspectors who go round and have a big long shopping list and they say, right, you haven't got that right, that's a fine. You haven't got that right, that's a fine. You haven't got that right, that's a fine. So the game of the company, literally game theory, is to say, we have to pass the inspection, we've got to reduce the number of fines. What happens the next day doesn't matter. This shows that France's statistics have stayed high. They kill more people and injure them in construction sites than any other country in Europe, and they have been doing that for a very long time. Germany saw what the UK is doing, so they followed it, and guess what? Their statistics have been going down. It's not the rules, because the rules are the same. It's European-based health and safety legislation. It's how you do it. It's regulatory delivery and behaviour. Same thing, you get the point, in relation to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, completely different area. They saw various types of problems, and this is the particular one in relation to meat and poultry processing, but there are others to do with maternity rights or various other strands, within which they said, we've got a choice. There's widespread problems. Are we going to go out with a big stick and hit a few people, or are we going to make it their problem and try and help them? So they did that, like the HSE, and it's worked. I won't bother reading all the stuff, but I mean, one point in that is that the solutions for business came from business. And various interesting studies published recently about involvement with supermarkets, etc. So, taking a fresh look, therefore, enforcement is simply the wrong concept. In addition to deterrence being the wrong concept, we've got to look at behaviour and what people do and think about how are people applying rules, but even that's the wrong concept, is what are they doing? Are they doing the right thing? So we've abandoned the two extremes of command and control and self-regulation, and we put them together into a different approach. If you quote from Ruth Steinholtz, with whom I'm just completing a book on this, which you will see outside. Please collect one, because you'll get money off, I think. Ruth says, if you focus on compliance, you will fail. Compliance cannot be an objective. It has to be an outcome. Various other comments like that. So many enforcers would think that, okay, we're trying here to achieve compliance. Well, you won't do it that way. You might end up with that result if you do it another way. How do we do that? Take a step back, think about behavioural science. Now, at this point, one, I'm on very thin ice, because I'm not a psychologist. Secondly, there are an awful lot of really very good summaries around in a lot of Penguin or similar paperback books about these days. And summarising, and indeed there was a page or so in The Economist on this last week, which was quite a good summary, that came out of OECD conference. Humans make many decisions quickly. Now, the rational actor model doesn't apply here at all. Most of us make decisions rather too quickly on gut feel, especially if our brain thinks that we've met this before, we know what to do, or we're in a hurry, or we're not thinking. So there's a book about fast brain and slow brain, and heuristics, etc. In other words, fast responses. We can take a decision and then immediately seek to rationalise it, even when it's wrong. Indeed, Dan Ariely has written a book on this, saying we are predictably irrational. So again, the idea of the economic rational actor simply doesn't apply. Humans are predictably irrational in doing all sorts of stupid things. We suffer from inertia and procrastination. We are not the rational actors. Good people, or people who think they're trying to do the right thing, often do stupid things, break rules, usually not seriously. We might think, oh, it doesn't matter, like going over 30 miles an hour. People think we comply even if obviously we don't. We're strongly influenced by social groups, so we follow the herd. And that was what HSE and the Equality and Human Rights Commission were trying to do. They were trying to create basically a herd there. And we're also influenced by a concept of fairness. Group culture is very important. Now, it is true, and this is a reinterpretation of the classic economics theory, that people will not break rules where you can be reminded that they perceive that the risk of being identified is high. So that is one way within which one can do that. Example, speeding. You see a yellow speed trap, you slow down, and then you can speed up again. However, if you're on a motorway and you've got a digital average speed, most people don't. You drive at 50 at that point, whatever else you do the rest of the time. Even the slow ones usually drive at 50, rather amusing. Because we're going to be identified. The fine, the points may not matter that much, but it's, oh yes, reminder, I'm going to be embarrassed. So that's going back to the two gentlemen shaking hands, embarrassment issue. Perception. One can do that, but you can't do that. And the Economist said this quite a while ago. You can't run society like that. We can't spy on each other and identify things going wrong all the time. And it wouldn't be a very nice society if we did that anyway. You can use that in relation to various nudge theories, which behavioural insights scientists do about trying to get people to pay tax on time. With, for example, with the phrase 90% of people in this area pay their tax on time, and the numbers go up. There are lots of books on that. So there are approaches. Now, one also finds that genetic mutation and human genetics, the thing that made humans different, Homo sapiens different from every other species and enabled Homo sapiens to dominate the planet, was a genetic mutation that produced, if you like, an ethical gene, because it enabled us to distinguish between right and wrong. In other words, if you can distinguish between right and wrong, are you telling me the truth? Can I collaborate with you? Can I put trust in you? One looks at a whole bag of evidence, some of which may be inconsistent, but saying, how do I know? But as soon as you've got the concept of right and wrong, then you can collaborate, and that's what enabled, so the evolutionary biologists say, the Homo sapiens to escape remarkably quickly out of a small tribe in Africa about 70,000 years ago and dominate the entire planet. And we've dominated every other species. And it's because of that genetic mutation, I suggest, that enabled collaboration and then specialisation between different groups. There's lots of philosophy as well. One can read statements like Baroness Honora O'Neill looking at evidence and judgment and communication. There's a very good book, I'm going to leave a few bits out, by Francis Fukuyama, which is quite old, but a lot of his writing, that particular book was called Trust, and a lot of the books since then have picked up the same point. He says you look at the societies within which they have the ability to trust or not trust, and you can see that some are economically much more successful because they know how to collaborate properly. Draws distinctions between Japan, China, Africa, etc., and Europe over time. So if we want to expand cooperation, we should be looking for ways within which individuals can signal that they can be trusted, and that that's true, and encourage them. And at that point, a very large bell rings, I hope, in relation to what the HSE and Equality and Human Rights Commission were doing. They're looking at social arrangements of saying, it's your problem, let's look at it. Similarly, there was a celebrated psychologist, Abraham Maslow, who developed a sequence of stages of human development. And that's been taken further by Fernand Laloux, who suggests that we as a race are now at a stage of getting to a new form of global collaboration, somewhat painfully, and there will be steps forward and backward. But in order to collaborate in that way, we have to reinvent all the arrangements for doing it. Because we're no longer a tribe, we're no longer a small medieval town, we have to look at global arrangements. The two gentlemen shaking hands, 19th century. How do we reinvent that concept at the moment? So I come back to the question, how do we actually make real the regulated self-assurance policy that the government is talking about, and I think rightly. All this chimes with quite a lot within regulatory theory. So Cunningham and Grabowski's concept of smart regulation, Julia Black's decentered regulation, involving lots of people being coordinated, and Christine Parker's book, 10 years old now, on open corporations, about producing evidence and trust and arrangements. Karl Polanyi, by the way, in 1944 said the problem with the Industrial Revolution was that economics started dominating how business was run, and therefore, if you like, the two gentlemen shaking in hands left the scene. In other words, you have to re-embed the economic approach in the social approach. And that's what I think the challenge is at the moment. So if we add the ethical and behavioural dimension to what we're doing, what struck me when I read the behavioural psychology was that there were some pretty clear conclusions about when people will obey rules voluntarily. And I might be wrong, but this is what I thought. The three conditions are the rule is made fairly, it's applied fairly, and the substance of the rule is fair. In other words, a fair process could be consultation, could be parliamentary, fair application to everyone equally. But if you do something bad, you would equally expect a proportionate response. Predictable, because one's got systems within which the society does things in ways that you can equate and find things that are proportionate. But the interesting thing is the moral questions around the fairness of the rules. So you can have plenty of rules that say, well, you don't need to pay too much tax in this jurisdiction. But people say, that's not fair. The Ministry of Economy in Scotland, when I was talking to him about this, said, I see what you're saying, because when I go to my constituency in Glasgow, they say to me, what you're doing is no right. Same point. Therefore, fairness underpins all of this. So let's think about that and putting fairness back into regulation and behaviour. Because it's about behaviour, it's not about rules so much. Another point, And this goes back to the Polanyi point about we need to deconstruct quite a lot of just thinking about business in economic terms on their own. The classic economic model is that companies concentrate exclusively on maximising shareholder value. Plenty of writing from the 1980s saying that that's gone horribly wrong, and the agency theory that's accompanied with it as incentivised managers to achieve maximum profit, and that's been blamed for driving excessive pay for senior executives and a sequence of corporate scandals and disasters, because there's been no institutional or behavioural break on maximising profit behaviour. So, for example, John Armour of Oxford and Jeff Gordon of Columbia argue that the shareholder value norm creates incentives for firms systematically to undermine the efficacy of regulatory internalisation mechanisms, thereby failing to avoid the significant externalities that were thought to be avoided. And very recently in the Harvard Business Review, Joseph Bauer and Lynn Payne have attacked the shareholder value model head on, saying that it's flawed in its assumptions, it's legally confused, and it's damaging in practice. In contrast, we are now seeing various books coming out of business schools that show that some companies that place great emphasis on putting customers first, treating staff well, paying suppliers properly and not messing them around, sourcing from chains that don't include child labour, not paying bribes, not entering into cartels, or at least not trying to, adopting corporate social responsibility programmes, observing the United Nations RAGI guidelines on business and human rights, and so on, those companies are doing quite well. Some really interesting statistics. Now, difficult to prove empirically at the moment because you can't compare exactly a clinical trial, for example, situations. But the evidence is quite interesting. However, in that long litany of things I just read out, like corporate social responsibility and bribery, etc., all those are individual boxes. Everyone's thinking about all of those at the moment, and how do we put them all together? Because I think if we could put them all together into one box, life would be an awful lot easier for people in companies. Some of them have occurred over time for different reasons. Won't go into that. John Kay has written that the most profitable businesses are not the most profit-oriented, and he argues that happiness is not achieved through the pursuit of happiness. Quote, happiness is not a red Ferrari. That's just a status symbol. And as soon as you've got it, you're fed up with it. Similarly, Colin Mayer points out that shareholder value is an outcome, not an objective. Heard that phrase earlier on. And there's a book by Cecilia Sheff and Wolf recently looking at 57 US public and private companies and 15 companies from the rest of the world, where they identified them as operating as firms of endearment. In other words, they're trying to do everything right and love everyone. It's a great big hug in. But actually, their results are rather spectacular because cumulative shareholder returns over 15 years for the US companies were 1,681% increase, and the rest of the world was 1,180%, as opposed to the Standard & Poor's 500 companies rate of a mere 117%, bit of a difference. And they call culture the secret ingredient. We had a meeting here last year when the chief executive of Northern Gas Networks was here, and he was saying, well, that's what we've done in the company. We try and treat everyone right. We try and do the right thing. And they did various tests internally and worked out what values people picked up on. So he has people who go out digging up the roads, digging up the pavement and all the rest of it. And he said the values that they responded to were, we're doing this with love. So you can just imagine these, because Northern Gas is based in Leeds. Forgive the accent, but I do come from around there, at least part of me does. He's like, it's all right, love, we're digging up your pavements, but we're doing it with love. In other words, they would think about, are we getting in people's way? How can we minimise that? Can we tell them in advance, etc., etc.? So it's shorthand for the behaviour, but they'd remember that very simple mnemonic because it's almost a joke, and put it into practice in what they were doing. So let's put it all in one box. Very simple, ethical business practice and regulation. Ruth and I are still tinkering with the wording, but the basic proposition is, let's do the right thing all the time. If we're not sure what the right thing is, check. Ask, are we doing things right? For example, a checking mechanism, because there's a distinguished ombudsman in the room, would be to join an ombudsman scheme. And he'll tell you what your complaints are and what you're doing wrong and right and how you should improve on various things. And the point, therefore, behind ethical business regulation is to say, let's incentivize that by having a specific relationship between businesses that try to do the right thing with EBP, and then you put it into a relationship with EBR. So there is, for example, a relationship between the HSE, or Quality and Human Rights, Food Standards Agency is another one, and certainly I've got a couple of others within primary authority coming up. That is quite similar to what you find, I'm pleased to say, in the Regulatory Futures Review, again, where they said at the bottom, in practice, this concept of regulated self-assurance and putting responsibility down to where it really lies, this means that businesses who do the right thing should be regulated with a very light touch. As part of this, regulators should encourage more ethical business practices. However, where regulated entities do not do the right thing and do not follow business practices, redress should be sought. Redress not used absolutely correctly there. But the point is, there are two tracks here. If a company wants to do things right and enter into the right sort of relationship, you're on the ethical track, and that's a different relationship. If not, fine. Business as usual in relation to enforcement. Examples of this, I'll move through these very quickly. You learn an enormous amount from aviation safety because they do this. They've been doing it for years. Planes wouldn't fly without what I call ethical business practice and ethical business regulation. It's a no-blame relationship, and they always own up to what's going on. They have to share information. The data is critical to looking at why did this happen? Was it a near miss? What root cause analysis all the time. So they've redefined the concept of accountability or responsibility on a social basis. The worst thing someone could do is not own up when they discover something having gone wrong. So you tell people and then they can sort it out. Some interesting stories behind that. Another one, primary authority scheme. Primary authority, very interesting, and it's, we probably haven't got time to go into this, but it's a relationship between a lot of authorities and, say, the national headquarters of a business and all the local outlets. The relationship is the bit that's not there, but actually exists, not drawn on that slide. Now, this has only been in existence for a few years, but it's been an outstanding success. Incidentally, the relationship equally strongly has happened between the local authorities on a horizontal basis. But the vertical relationship is very important. Now, one important point there is that the business can say, what should I be doing? Have I done something wrong? How do we improve? Statement recently in relation to explaining primary authority, saying, we want to work with you to help your business to be compliant and successful. It is important to us that you should feel able to come to us for advice when you need it. We won't take enforcement action just because you ask us a question or tell us that you have a problem. Completely different from a deterrent approach. Food standards, doing very much the same thing. Water prices in Scotland, a different area because that's economic regulation, and they've recently issued their methodology for looking at the next price review. It's rather embarrassing, it quotes me really too much in there, but they're basically saying we're going to all cards on the table, and both sides, regulators and the company, are now collaborating in a completely different way, producing skeletons out of the cupboard to say, well, we've never been quite sure what to do about this. It's now a shared problem. Let's work out the answer. So issues are being dealt with and sorted out. How do we take things forward? Well, this is actually, there's a lot of it about, but it needs to be pulled into an integral model. So the relationship between regulated self-assurance and ethical business practice and ethical business regulation needs to be solidified. There's a sequence of pilot studies that are now going on. The different approach to compliance and the different approach to behaviour obviously has to start on the right-hand side by the businesses, but it has to be encouraged by the regulators in the middle, who have to change the way they do things and encourage businesses who want to come forward and say, we do actually want to have a different relationship with you. It has also to be supported by government on the left-hand side. That's rather an important topic for which there isn't enough time, but I merely state that the Scottish government have already adopted this as a policy, national policy of fairness in Scotland, and have adopted EBR. Great. And therefore things are moving on. Quite a few studies, or more or less formalised, are now coming on. And we will see more evidence coming out of working out what the relationship means and what the details of it are in different circumstances. There are various areas that are not on here because they're jolly difficult. So one which I'm building up to is the NHS. Another one is financial services. But there are all sorts of complications about getting there. The bottom line here is that there is therefore an answer to how do we deal with compliance and regulation and enforcement? How do we deal with that in the middle space? How do we deal with that in relation to the new policy of regulated self-assurance? It is not self-regulation by the back door. We can actually solidify this. That makes a huge difference, but it's choice of people as to whether they're actually going to do it. Thank you very much.